Good morning. Good morning, my friends. It is Friday. Thank goodness it's Friday, April the 11th, 2025, Boblimpdoc, and I'm just here on the Olympic Peninsula at around 3:33 a.m. drinking my cafe au lait, pondering the great nature of the Gumbus people, thinking about the lesbian sky warriors battling in their vacuum ships 30 miles above the surface of the earth, thinking about a lot of weird stuff. Yeah, they're up there every day battling. You know, why are they battling? I don't know. Why do cats fight? Why do cats fight? Anyways, the first topic is a well-known subject for my listeners. This is a fortune cookie, attendees A&W-style Chinese Ching Chong racist prophecy, and I'm about to unleash it to the world. Oh boy, can I get it open? I don't know. Here comes the prophecy. Oh, and it came in plastic this time. So there's three layers. It's like a multi-stage thermonuclear weapon here. So I got a little plastic bag I gotta open. Oh, boy, it looks like a lot of supply chains are being hit right. And now I can crack it open. Yep, there we go. A three-stage nuclear device. Here is my A&W-style attendees prophecy. Tomorrow, your friend or partner will tell you some exciting news. Well, here's the thing. I have a couple friends, but for the most part, they're not local. I don't have a partner currently. I'm not really sweating it. I'm not incel. It's more like I'm volcel, which is to say, at this point in my life, having a partner, for all the things that you miss, you do remember the things that kind of sucked about it. So I don't really sweat it. So it can't be a partner has exciting news. It would be a friend has exciting news. But that sounds like a curse too. Kind of like that Proverbs, you know, I think 24:17 or something. Kind of like that 27:14. The point is kind of like that Proverbs, right? You know, if you say good morning to somebody, you're probably cursing them. I know that's a paraphrase, but you know what I'm saying. Exciting news. And the other thing, too, is that the concept of exciting or crazy or chaos and opportunity are supposedly the same symbol in Chinese. So I don't know, folks. We'll see. Next topic. I'm going to drink some cafe au lait. So we've covered these subjects before, but in terms of the recent news, and especially all this stuff about the state of Israel and what it's been doing, it's worth reviewing as Sovietologists the places we're going to probably find the truth, you know, if we practice our Sovietology very well. If we look at the taboo, the concepts that are forbidden for debate, forbidden for conversation, forbidden for research. If we look at the taboo, the things that we are not allowed to question, that's a good place to start. The next step is to look at the ridicule. Look at what gets made fun of. Look at the paid clowns. Al Gore's a paid clown. Greta is a paid clown. Look at the ridicule. That's a good place to find the truth, buddy. Look at who gets made fun of and why. Look for the things that are obscured by smoke, and in that figurative sense, smoke, but really by drama, by noise. Look at the noisiest speaker. Look at the noisiest system out there. Look at the thing that creates the most screeching. And you might find some truth there too, but you'll have to pick up the rock and watch the greasy things scatter away, sort of like social media influencers. If you know, you know. So look at those things at the obscure. Technically, another name for that is the occult. Look to the margins, the edges of everything, of art, of music, you know, music is art, whatever, of art, science, engineering. Look at the edges of politics, the margins. Look at the edges of where you live. Look at the people that live on the margins. Look at the marginal things, and you might find some truth there too. And always keep in mind that in a neo-Stalinist hellhole, which is what we're living in, if you think this is free enterprise, you're on crack, son, and you are on crack. But in this deeply immersive, confused, muddled, neo-Stalinist hellhole, the truth is more often than not shrouded in layers of deception, of lies. Lots and lots of lies. So even if you think you're getting close to the truth, chances are, you know, you've got more work to do. Same with me. But I think the number one point here is the taboo. Look to the taboo. If someone says you can't ask a question, then probably you should ask a question. If somebody starts giving you a horror story, Dan, my grandma exploded when she got the monkey herpes. My dog grew extra horns when he got the monkey herpes. Dogs don't have horns. We don't care. Look to the people telling you those dramatic tales. Dramatic tales of woe. And these aren't people you'll ever know. These aren't people you know in person. These are social media constructs, constructs for news, for quote-unquote journalism. These are, in many cases, made-up people. And this practice of creating fake people, especially clowns like Al Gore and Greta Thunberg, this practice goes back to the beginning of human history. It goes back to the beginning of the clandestine world. Creating make-believe people as a going concern has been a thing for a long time, and it's really low tech. You don't have to have computers or video. You just have to either hire somebody who's good at this, A, also called a spy, or B, you just construct a person and then you dispose of them when you don't need them no more. So also ask that question, if you can, when you're trying to find the truth. How can I trust this person I'm listening to include me? Like, I don't know how the fuck you verify that I exist, that I am who I am. If all you have is the internet, I don't think there's a chance in hell you can verify it. I could be at one of those U.S. Air Force troll farms, the ones I talk about. That is, in essence, what a sheepdog would do. That's a limited hangout, and I could be one. And I think it's appropriate to ask those questions. We are at a point in human history, and we've been here for about 5 years, where what is happening and what is about to happen has never happened before. Probably never. If it's just the collapse of the dollar, if that's all it is, folks, and frankly, I consider that bright siding at this point. There has never been an empire like this in the history of the world, as far as we know. Never. The Romans never got this big. The Mongolians never got this big. There has never been an empire like the dollar, like the United States dollar empire, ever. And it is crumbling before our eyes. And the master magician, the wizard of all this, the Papa Blumbity Blump, he's probably fake too. Or let me put it this way. Trump is real to the extent that the dollar has intrinsic value. And so as people chase the dollar down the hole, they're going to probably smoke a bowl and realize that Papa Blumpity Trump is probably fake as well. He's a Fugazi. He's fake. It doesn't mean he wasn't born Donald Trump, but I think he served a purpose. In fact, it's hard to imagine that he did not get recruited at some point by the Central Intelligence Agency. And you say, well, Dan, there's no record of him being in the CIA. And it's like, buddy, I just wish I could hit you in the head with the idiot stick and knock some sense into you. The CIA doesn't really publish everybody that works for the CIA, and sometimes it's a lot of people that are just independent contractors or regular schmucks who want to make an extra buck. Like, let's say you're a real estate demon who builds all these real estate schemes, but they're basically designed to implode. Yeah, a guy like that might need some money. A real estate mogul who wants to be one but really is mostly good at going bankrupt. Yeah, he could get recruited. Anyways, next topic. Practice your Sovietology, brothers and sisters, because I think we're getting close to the end. I really do. It could be my own bias. It could be my own ignorance. It could be hubris, stupidity. It could be the compulsion to believe things you need to believe because you need to believe. And even if it does happen, it could be purely accidental. But when I sensed in late 2019, along with a lot of other people, that all the tables were about to get tipped over, it was kind of like certainty. At a certain point, it became certain. I knew in November 2019 that tables were about to be tipped over in a big way. I wasn't entirely sure what it would look like, but I was certain it was coming. This next step, as we leave Boblimptok behind, and really Boblimptok is just another way of saying bullshit, as we leave all the psyops behind and we actually get to see the thing they've been trying to hide, it's going to be ugly. And like I said, best case, it's the collapse of the dollar empire. And if you think that's not going to be a crack up crazy, you're a lazy thinker.
But Dan, crypto will save us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe a friend will show up tomorrow on Saturday, the 12th of April, with a shit ton of crypto. And maybe that's the thing they're talking about at 10D's A&W Chinese restaurant. I have no idea. Next topic. So this was published on the pewresearch.org site, and I'm just going to read a portion of it, not all the data. It was published April the 8th, 2025 by Laura Silver. The author is Laura Silver, and the subject or headline is How Americans View Israel and the Israel-Hamas War at the Start of Trump's Second Term. And I'm just going to say this. When I see pictures of Trump right now, guys, every time I see a picture of Trump, he looks like he has dioxin poisoning. He really does. His face looks orange, but oranger than normal. And if he, you know, usually you die of dioxin poisoning relatively quickly. I don't know. It's a little slow. He looks like he has dioxin poisoning. I don't know. And if he did, who knows why? I mean, this is the thing, folks. When you're putting together, I know that I'm going back to the previous topic, but I think it's relevant. When you're putting together a make-believe person, they're either recruited. Actually, it's not that simple. They could be recruited, which means they know that they're faking it, but they're also a real person, so their name's being reused. It's a sheep-dipping process. Or they're 100% manufactured, and it just really, from the ground up, there's no real person there. If it's a real person at some point in the game, maybe they're not in on it. Maybe they think they're in on it, but they're not. Which is another way of saying, last summer, when they had that McPoyle assassination attempt, it looked fake as fuck to me. Oh, Dan, somebody died. You know, somebody would have had to die to make it seem real. But which also means that the people that faked it also killed someone. Hey, but none of you guys are going to investigate what really killed Grandma, so I doubt you're going to look into this. Though you will spend decades on Sandy Hook. He could be a person who was recruited, which means he was sheep-dipped, which means Donald Trump is actually a person, and he could think he's in on it. But like I said last summer, a great scenario is Donald Trump is a surfboard. And, you know, J.D. Trance and Gulsi Gabbard will ride that surfboard into the future. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but every picture now, he looks like he's been poisoned. So getting back to the article, headlined How Americans View Israel and the Israel-Hamas War at the start of Trump's second term by Laura Silver. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the United States on April the 7th for the second time since President Donald Trump took office. As Americans look at the Middle East, fewer say the Israel-Hamas war is important to them personally or important to U.S. national interests, fewer than felt that way earlier last year, according to a Pew Research Center survey. In addition, the public's views of Israel have turned more negative. Over the past 3 years, more than half of U.S. adults, 53%, now express an unfavorable opinion of Israel, up from 42% in March 2022, before the Hamas attack of October the 7th, 2023, and the ensuing Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip. Pew Research Center regularly asks about attitudes towards countries like Russia, the U.S., China, and others, blah, blah, blah. Americans' confidence in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also remains relatively low, 32%, according to the new survey. The survey was conducted March 24th through 30th, just before Netanyahu's most recent visit, among a nationally representative sample of 3,605 U.S. adults. So I'm going to go backwards first. This nationally representative sample of 3,605 U.S. adults, one would really want to see the actual score on this, the actual hypothesis score on this thing as far as the numbers go, the Z score, because I don't know. To me, the number seems still too small for these types of for this type of thing. But yeah, people say, well, but Dan, it was randomly selected from people that you can reach on their phone, right? Or people you can email. But a lot of people don't want to talk to strangers on the phone. And a lot of people think most of these emails are bullshit, scams. So I do wonder about these samples. I'm not saying they're bogus, but here's what I will say. And this is a good rule of thumb when it comes to Sovietology. If the story is bad, make it seem less bad. If the story is good, make it seem amazing. Make it seem like a miracle. It's like these Trump miracles. Saving the eggs for breakfast, stuff like that. I think that these numbers are worse. I cannot prove it, but my intuition tells me that you could take that 68% of Americans have a very low opinion of Netanyahu. I would guess that if you did a proper study, it'd be closer to the 90%. And as far as like the view of Israel having a favorable, unfavorable opinion, my guess is at least 70% of Americans have a very negative view of the state of Israel at this point. And I also think that that's something to understand and recognize as we come into the coming months and years, but really the coming weeks and months. As I've said in recent podcasts, this could be a limited hangout. This could be true, in a sense, that all of this is true, but it's not the truth. Like, here's the thing. People will talk about this war in terms of genocide. Okay, maybe, but it's really ethnic cleansing. And people will talk about it like it's a new thing. But the truth is, the state of Israel did this from the beginning. From 1948, they were ripping off people's land, stealing it, putting people there, and then saying, hey, look, gormlessly look, like the meme, at the fact that there are families there now. Well, yeah, because you put families there. They've been doing this since 1948. So the idea that this is special, it's not. The only thing that really makes it special, and this is the point that I try to make, and people don't understand, but I hope you do understand. The thing that makes it special is how retarded it is. It's definitely evil, but the reality is the slow roll ethnic cleansing that the Israelis have been doing for the last, whatever, 70 fucking years, more or less, the slow roll's been working. In another 10 or 20 years, Gaza, the West Bank, all of those areas would be cleared out. So the question people should be asking, but they're not asking because it's a scary question, is why the fucking rush? Because when I think about the McPoyle plot, that faggy and gay fake-ass assassination last July, and I think about 10-7 and the paragliders, what it indicates to me is about a year to 2 years ago, people said, we're in it. We're in the window. We thought we were in the window in 2019, and we verified it. Which means if you have stuff to do, Israel, if you have work to get done, you don't have 20 years, you don't have 30 years, you've got 18 months. Probably, plus or minus, buddy. Anyways, you guys think on it the way you want to. My guess is a lot of Americans, if you give them a moment of clarity where they can sit down, put down their quote-unquote smart device and just meditate on it, if you gave them all the data, all the money we've given the state of Israel, how many people the state of Israel has killed since 1948, how much land they've ripped off, and all of these stupid wars that for the most part serve the state of Israel. If Americans could sit down and focus on that, I think most would probably, 80% would probably say, fuck them. We don't want to have a relationship with these nasty ass Jonestown cultist Zionist freaks any longer. But even then I'd say, that's not really the story. Next topic. Dan, I can't believe you. I can believe me. If you reach for it, and that's the thing, a lot of people don't reach for it. They don't reach for it. Their dogs and cats don't reach for Zenrelia. And really, how long does $1 million last after 60? My guess is, given I'll be there in about 5 frickin' years? Not long at all, buddy. The best thing to do with eggshells is to put baking soda in the toilet tank. The best thing to do with eggshells is to shove it up your toilet tank. Take a bunch of dead eggs, take all your dead poems, take your wood chips, and your broken glass, and your metal shavings, mix it with the eggshells, and put baking soda in your toilet tank. Your toilet tank can be clear. You don't need no colonoscopy. There ain't nothing to see down there that's worth seeing. Only the pain of ages. Dan, you're crazy. I know I'm crazy. I'm okay with it. We're all going crazy right now. Here's a quote from Dr. Freckles. Train a replacement. Because everyone gets hit by the bus. Very soon, the buses will have sex with a chicken that has monkey herpes. The chicken got it from a cow. The cow got it from a pig. The pig had sex with a food processing plant that caught fire after a hobo with a Bic lighter set fire to the LA region, right? Hit by a bus. The buses are having sex. They are multiplying. They are everywhere. If it's important, train a replacement. If it's a job that needs to get done, train a replacement. If you have a family and you're trying to live off the grid, so to speak, and prepare for grinking time because you were thinking that you got a chance, maybe so. But if there are necessary skills like purifying water, scavenging for food, you know, finding food, foraging, hunting, security, a whole long list of things. If you have a family, you should be talking to your kids about these things. And guess what? You need to train a fucking replacement. Sorry. Next topic. Dan, you son of a bitch. Okay. Here is a storyline. I consider it to be a perfect arc. And there's more than one perfect arc out there. There's lots of them. And, you know, probably Joseph Campbell. You know, Hero with a Thousand Faces, all the books he wrote. He knew a lot of arcs that come from mythology and culture and ancient rituals. You know, Carl Jung, he understood arcs too. This is one of the perfect arcs. A group of abused, scantily clad female prisoners devise a plan. They have a plan to rebel against their evil oppressors. They will escape their prison. They will run into the jungle. They will get stuck in mud. They will cover themselves in clipsy-clap. They will be chased by guards into the stinky, stanky, steamy jungles, through the swamps, being chased by gators, and I think that's a pretty good arc. And I know I'm a son of a bitch. Maybe about 200 to 300 million years ago, some motherfucking amphibian got onto the beach and said, you know what? I kind of like it here. I'm staying. And so he found a girl who wanted to stay on the beach. He called her Betsy Beach, or Bitch for short. And Sclubbity Sclub and his wife Glimity Glim, they set up the first homeowners association on a beach. Perhaps, you know, 200 to 300 million years ago. Who knows? Maybe a little longer. That's an arc. It's like mold to man. It's like fungi to fungi. That's an arc too, isn't it? From little single-celled creatures getting together, putting on a show. At first, there was just chemistry. And then it became symbiotic. And all the little organelles formed a sheath around themselves and then figured out a split in two. And then now you have your man-goo. Your man-goo. Anyways, that's a dumb subject. Dumb subject, good name for a podcast. Next subject. So, this is another Sovietology thing. I'm going to read the article and then we're going to fucking talk about it, baby. We're going to talk about it. This is coming from the New York Post, and it was published on April the 8th. The 8th, 2025. Headline, Well-Preserved Baby Mammoth Dating Back to Ice Age Dissected by Scientists. Written by Andrea Margolis for Fox News, but this is published in the New York Post, again, April the 8th. And I read on. The mammoth, which has been nicknamed Yana, was dissected at the Northeastern Federal University of Yakutsk, Russia, on March the 27th. The baby mammoth had been preserved in permafrost until she was dug up in the cold Russian province of Yakutia last year. Pictures of the necropsy show a team of scientists huddled around the 397-pound animal, which closely resembles a modern-day baby elephant. The creature's mouth was open, and her trunk was curled as scientists opened up her skin. Scientists initially believed Yana lived 50,000 years ago, but that estimate was updated to over 130,000 years after the scientists analyzed the permafrost layer where she was found. Maxim Cherpazov, head of the Lazarev Mammoth Museum Laboratory, told Reuters last year that the mammoth was just over a year old when she died. The corpse was already partially eaten by predators when she was discovered. As a rule, the part that thaws out first, especially the trunk, is often eaten by modern predators or birds, Cherpasov told Reuters. Here, for example, even though the forelimbs have already been eaten, the head is remarkably well-preserved. Though the discovery of a well-preserved mammoth is exceedingly rare, it is not unheard of for other mammoth remains to be discovered. In June 2024, a fisherman found a mammoth bone on the banks of the Raba River in Kaczyszyn near Gdańsk, Poland. Okay. In August of the same year, a fossil collector discovered a portion of a Colombian mammoth tusk in an embankment in Madison County, Mississippi. So this article's interesting. They mix some things together, okay? There's a huge difference between finding a tusk in some mud, finding, you know, a mammoth bone on a river's edge. There's a big difference between that and finding flesh that has been halted in a state of decomposition, which is to say, finding frozen meat. There's a big difference. And the fact that this article kind of mixes this together, I think that this is on purpose. But the other thing is this, folks, when I, you know, 30 years ago when I was in school, generally speaking, if you read about mammoths being discovered, mostly they were about 10 to 12,000 years old. Sure, you'd read about older ones, but the ones we would find that were easy to find, which is to say the easiest layer probably is the youngest layer, which is probably, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Geologist, the top layer. Not always, but generally speaking, it is. And so, yeah, finding something that's 130,000 years old like this had to be easier in 2025 than doing it in 1925 or 1825. In fact, my guess is, even with today's technology, probably we wouldn't have found it because nobody would have been looking for it in the first place. I think that the real story here, the real truth is that this material was easier to find because the top layers, the layers above it, have thawed out and are converting to gas, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide. But you do your own thinking on this. I think it's an interesting story. I think there's more going on, but you do your own thinking. Like I said, there's a big difference between frozen meat and finding a bone. You know, they say they find bones all the time, right? Well, there you go. Here's a quote from Dr. Freckles. In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is despised. What does that mean, Dan? Well, think about it. If you're a Christian, or if you're Jewish, this applies, think on it. Think about the lives of the prophets, all the prophets, to including the greatest, who is also the Son of God. Think about the life of the prophets. They brought truth to a kingdom of blind people. And no matter which prophet you pick, you know, some people say Jeremiah is a great one, but whichever prophet you pick, if you look at their lives, they're not kings of a kingdom. They don't get in charge. Generally speaking, they're chased, they're attacked, they're harried. They barely stay alive around supposedly their own people. They get abducted. People try to kill them. I mean, the life of a prophet in the Bible in general is not a very good life. Not always is it terrible, but in general it's not so great. And the one thing that all these prophets tend to have in common is that the blind people despise them. They despise them for bringing a turd sandwich. You know, that's the thing. You come back to the people and say, the Lord loves you. The Lord's going to save you. The Lord's going to bring you out of Egypt. And even if that statement were false, a slave in Egypt would say, well, that's good news. But then what happens? Hundreds of years later, you know, the Israelites are in that what have you done for me lately mode and putting up little statues of Baal. And then a prophet shows up and says, you probably should stop doing this. This is wrong, and the Lord will punish you for it. That prophet, generally speaking, is not bringing news that makes people happy because that prophet isn't recognizing that the Israelites are angry and they grumble because they're in that what have you done for me lately mode. And it's very childish, but it is the nature of the Bible at that point in human history. You know, as I've said before, one way of looking at the Bible is how you might look at child development. The crudeness of the ethical framework of the early Bible tells the full truth. And people should understand that, yeah, these prophets who brought light to the darkness, who figured out ways to help out the people who were living in the kingdom of the blind, and in a few cases, specifically Jesus, actually gave the blind their sight back. In general, they end up being hated, and probably hated until the day that they're gone, and then maybe decades later, people look back and say, oh, we should have listened. In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is not king. He's not emperor. He's not mayor of the city. In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is hunted down, is tossed into an asylum, dies in the asylum, and then a few months later, everybody else dies. Next topic. Next topic, Dan Wright. Oh boy, this is a positive news story. So Elon Musk posted on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, he posted the following: Starship will hopefully depart for Mars at the end of next year with Optimus Explorer robots. Which again, you know, sending robots to Mars and shit, that's crazy ass shit. It's not people. It's sort of like, okay, you know, we've been waiting a while every 5 years. This is important too. My whole life, the numbers that were critical when it comes to space, workable fusion energy, the robot that everybody can afford and takes care of our lives for us, it's always been 5 or 10 years away. 5 or 10 years. Dan, in about 5 or 10 years, we're going to have a hooker republic on Mars. In 5 or 10 years, you're going to have your own flying car. In 5 or 10 years. But this story says next year. And there have been a lot of stories like that recently. Next year, we're going to do this. Next year, we're going to do that. Next year, everyone's going to get a $5,000 check from the Doge. The Doge dividend. I think this is telegraphing. I think there have been other kinds of telegraphing going on, if you're sensitive to it. I think this is another way of saying that whatever's happening this year, right now, you know, whatever you got at the grocery store, whatever joy you have in life with your job and whatever else, 2026 is not going to be what you expect, and is probably going to be as shocking a transition as 2019 was to 2020. And it might start a lot sooner. Like, it could be that this is only a few weeks away. It really could be. The madness, the crazy, what's coming. 10 years ago, I would call it the soul harvest. And other people have used that phrase for the last decade, the soul harvest. A great harvest of souls. Well, how do you do that, giving up the ghost? By the way, that's an arc too, isn't it? It's in the Bible. Big arc, big arc, big arc. Goes right to the end. The arc to the arc. Fungi to fungi. Mold to man. Here's another quote from Dr. Freckles. Basis points be like, we'll slice the bread thinner so everyone feels fuller. We'll slice the bread thinner. You'll get more slices, but less bread, and you'll feel better. When I was a kid, rarely did you hear people talk in terms of basis points when it came to the Federal Reserve. And this is back in the 70s and 80s. It was like whole interest points, up or down. It wasn't like, we're going to go this many fractions of a percentage up or down. Because that's what basis points are. And people think, well, Dan, you know, they can't do it like they used to. Well, I know why they can't, and so does Powell. Powell understands. He's, you know, basically chasing a bear, and he's also being chased by a tiger. And then when he switches to chasing the tiger, the bear chases him. But there is no way that he survives without either the bear, the tiger, or both tearing him to pieces. This is the end game of fiat currency. The bear and the tiger, okay, deflation and inflation, are both staring at you in the face, and no matter what move you make, fixing one problem makes the other problem worse. There is no slack. This is not the 1930s where one barrel of oil got you about 100. This is 2025. One barrel of oil gets you 3 or 4, right? And it ain't cheap. In 2014, the Obama administration, this is December 2014, the Obama administration and the GOP joined forces to do something. And it really got overlooked by a lot of people. They basically passed a law to put the American people on the hook for all the bad debt, all the bad derivatives, all the bad loans and anything hidden, all the crap that allows the fracking miracle of the fracking world to work. All of that, financial bullshit that the American people would pay for it. So that ultimately, on a certain level, they had nationalized our oil industry. For all intents and purposes, they don't know it yet, but this becomes a lot like the General Motors scenario. And also keep in mind, this is Obama and the GOP, which means, again, the Uniparty decided that if the fracking thing is too expensive and the wagers on it start to fail, we've got to support it. Years ago, I was told that you really can't make money in any legitimate way with fracking at below 90 bucks a barrel. And some people will come back and say, well, no, Dan, you can do it at 70 or 50. And it's hard to find a good number. Berman, last name Berman, I always forget his first name, but if you look him up in the oil world, he's written a lot on this. And the reality is, the numbers don't really add up. They don't make sense. We're at that point in the game. We're at the point in the game where, if it's just the collapse of the US dollar, there are going to be a lot of forces at work that will be bizarre and uncontrollable. Just the fact that so much of that money is going to come home. So yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit off topic here, but to me, the basis point thing was always suspect. Like, it was always suspect to me when they started talking that way all the time, because what it led me to believe is that they don't have any room to maneuver. They really don't. Powell has no room to maneuver. At some point, the bear or the tiger gets him. And you can always see he has an eye on the door to get to his helicopter. He has a helicopter. He named it. It's called Soft Landing. Next topic. Yeah, Powell ain't going to be in the building when this thing goes sideways. I can sense that. Here's another quote from Dr. Freckles. Nobody reads Derrida because they're happy. If you know Jacques Derrida and deconstruction, whatever, I'm going to read a little bit here from his famous difference essay. Just a little bit. The verb to differ seems to differ from itself. On the one hand, it indicates difference as distinction, inequality, or discernibility. On the other, it expresses the interposition of delay, the interval of a spacing, and a temporalizing that puts off until later what is presently denied. The possible that is presently impossible. Sometimes the different and sometimes the deferred correspond, like in French, to the verb to differ. This correlation, however, is not simply one between act and object, cause and effect, or primordial and derived. In the one case, to differ signifies non-identity. In the other case, it signifies the order of the same. Yet there must be a common, although entirely different, root within the sphere that relates to two movements of differing to one another. We provisionally give the name difference to the sameness, which is not identical. By the silent writing of its A, it has the desired advantage of referring to differing, both as spacing, temporalizing, and as the movement that structures every dissociation. This essay was originally published in 1968, and that was a real good year for France. Yeah. I don't know. I studied this crap in college. There's a lot to the whole deconstruction postmodernism thing that a lot of people don't get, and they treat it in kind of a cartoon way. One way of looking at it, and it's a little bit cartoonish, but I'm okay with it, is the following. There was, in the world of philosophy, specifically Western philosophy, mostly continental, which means Europe, but there was in the world of philosophy and metaphysics at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, something that people call the language crisis. This is not a real crisis. Real people don't have a language crisis. They simply use language. They use words to signify things, to do things. They don't think on it too much. And you know what? That kind of works. But for a lot of philosophers, to include people like Bertrand Russell, there was something wrong. They wanted to have a perfected language. In Bertrand Russell's case, he wanted to perfect mathematics in such a way that it was simply true without respect to any kind of axiom. It was simply true. You would understand it to be true. The world could be described in perfectly true ways, and we could escape the ignorance of the past. You know, Mr. McScrumbly, his wife, setting up the first HOA 300 million years ago. We could escape all that scrubbly bullshit. Others, like Martin Heidegger, went down a slightly different road. And their perspective was, we need to understand the consciousness of a person who used the words in ancient Greek, in ancient Greece. It's not good enough to read a translation of Plato's Republic, for example. And it's not even good enough to read it in modern Greek. And it's not even good enough to read it in ancient Greek. You have to go deeper. You have to go as deep as possible into the meaning. This is hermeneutics, basically. And by the way, when you practice Sovietology, on one level, you are practicing hermeneutics, which means you're taking a deep dive into the cultural context of the words themselves. And if you're reading the Bible, guess what? You kind of have to, you have to kind of take that perspective too, to some extent. You need to understand the context of the words. We do. If we're reading the Bible, the discernment comes with the Holy Spirit, and it's kind of incumbent upon us to ask questions, because the Lord made us the type of being that wants to ask questions. And the taboo, I don't think there's anything, any subject the Lord ever said you can't talk about. He told us things we shouldn't do. Yeah, definitely. There's a list of things we should never do. But there was never a case of saying this is a scary word, unless you go back to the beginning. Unless you go back to Eden, where he said, stay away from that tree. And maybe that's it too. Like, maybe it's always been a thing. Certain things we don't have a right to understand or question. I can't imagine in a free society that's a good philosophy. But historically, many things have been taboo, off limits, forbidden. Anyways, the language crisis was not a real crisis, but for philosophers, it was about being able to describe the world in such a way that there was little or no ambiguity, little or no huge amounts of debate. It's like Leibniz, who proposed building a machine in his day and age that could resolve any type of dispute. You know, it would simply calculate. It would calculate not just numbers, it would calculate human problems. Leibniz had an understanding of what was possible in the future. They didn't have the technology to build the thing he wanted then, the von Neumann machine, the modern computer, but Leibniz suspected that such a machine would be built, I think. So there are those two basic approaches. You can perfect the language or you can understand it. Jacques Derrida fits somewhere in that muddy middle. And after the language crisis imploded, what you have is, you know, things like existentialism and, you know, frankly, the structuralists, like, Foucault is a good example. And then after that, you have the postmodern bullshit. And a lot of that gets associated with our good friend Jacques Derrida. If that's right or wrong, I really don't give a fuck. Next topic. Man, you're crazy. I know. I keep saying it. You keep saying it. So I'm not going to go into depth here, but there was a headline about the Trump administration considering bailouts for U.S. farmers. And ostensibly, The reason is because of, you know, China's retaliatory tariffs. I am not going to read the article, but I'm going to tell you what I think, and it's very consistent to what I've been telling you. I think the tariff stuff is about locking down the food. And I think at this point, every government on earth has been told, what you have is what you have. Nobody's going to be sharing. No one's going to be sharing. No one's going to be moving that grain around. The grain, the food we have right now, countries are going to hold on to it. And I think that's either been explicit or implicit, and it could be either. So when you look at these tariff stories, and specifically any story about bailing out farmers, understand it means something very different. They're locking down the food. Next topic. Why would they lock down the food, Dan? I don't know. Does that sound like fiat currency collapse or something worse? So this is another article. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read a section of an article that deals with the weirdness of the markets of recent days, and then we'll talk about it, but just a section. Some market participants said they believe, based on the dramatic treasury market moves and sharp tightening of swap spreads, that investors, including hedge funds, have been selling liquid assets, such as U.S. government bonds, to meet margin calls due to portfolio losses across asset classes. Okay. I call this a neo-Stalinist hellhole. And the reason I do this is because we do have what Lenin would have called war communism, which means some quote-unquote free enterprise. Not very much at this point, not as much as you might think, but we have a little bit. And within the complexity of a market, there are weird phenomena that become spontaneous. And depending upon the complexity of that space, that maybe a better analogy would ultimately be, as so many people say, a casino. Some of these casinos are complex. They have lots of people gambling, lots of different games, and some of these games are connected. And then some of these games are connected, but we don't always see it. The entire world of derivatives and these other types of insurance bets, wagers, I call them scams, the entire world of derivatives is based upon the assumption that a decision has value. It's not just that an asset has value, but you're actually creating contracts and, frankly, recognizing wealth in terms of decisions. Someone's decision is worth something. It's worth $1 million, $10 million, and you put that. You put that someplace. You know, you put it? CalPERS. You know, CalPERS, you know, the employee retirement fund. You put it in lots of places, and it makes their portfolio look strong while things look good. But the thing about these types of situations is that they can be very unstable. They seem super stable, and you say, well, Dan, they're so stable. The math always adds up. Until it doesn't, though, like in 2008. And I think 2008 is kind of nothing compared to probably what's going to happen over the next few weeks. It's just that I don't think it's the whole story. I think it's kind of like more smoke. It's bigger than a trauma monkey. It's definitely a lesser catastrophe at this point. Like if you're saying, Dan, I could lose my 401k, yeah, it could be gone. In fact, any type of retirement, and I'm going to include military pensions, all these funds could be vaporized either through debasement or just, you know, basically being shut down. And I think debasement is most likely. So yeah, you might still get the same amount of money every month, but it might not buy what you think it will buy. And that's best case scenario. I think this is more smoke. I think it's purposeful smoke. I think it's related to economics. I don't think it's, you know, completely detached. And I think that there are casino phenomena that will and necessarily must occur. And if this is the best case, which means the collapse of the U.S. dollar, it's going to be cascading. It's going to be random. It's going to be discontinuous and brutal. And that's just if the dollar is currently imploding. But I think it's worse, you know? And I wouldn't even know how to begin to explain it other than I think it's worse. And having said that, I don't always do this. I'm going to do it today. I haven't done it much recently. There's a donation link to my podcast. If you want to donate, you can. You don't have to. I'm also selling t-shirts, and I've had good feedback. So if you see a t-shirt, you know, that could be the way that you donate. You get something and you donate a little, but it's up to you. But frankly, don't do it. And then especially don't do it and listen to the disclaimer. Take care of your food, water, shelter first. It might be really important right now to make sure you have storable food on hand. Maybe 6 months, and that's optimism. 6 months, I would say a year. Make sure you have a means to purify water. Stored food, purify water, and some type of shelter that's intact. If you don't have these things, then take the little bit of money you have and get them, and do not donate to me. If there are people in your life that need help, I don't mean make-believe internet people. I don't mean people you've never met, you think they're real. A lot of scams out there, folks. A lot of honeypots, a lot of woe-is-me bullshit. And maybe 1 out of 100 is true, but you can't know, and most of it's crap. If there are real people in your life, family, friends, real people, maybe even a neighbor right down the street that need your help, help them first. Help them always before you donate to anybody on the internet for any kind of podcast or other type of bullshit. Keep in mind, I don't think it's the end of the world, but I do think normality, what's left of it, is about to vaporize. I mean, what's left of what you think, if you believe in the American dream, understand that it's still kind of here to the extent that it was ever true, but it's about to be completely gone. And so while you can still do things like go to a restaurant, go to a movie, enjoy a world that isn't totally chaotic and like, you know, Mad Max. While you can still participate in life and find joy, do it. Take the little bit of money you have after taking care of the things you need to and give yourself a fucking break. And do that before you ever, ever, ever donate to my podcast, ever. And if you have pets, dogs and cats, as I always say, if you're prepping for yourself, make sure you're prepping for them too. And that includes any type of parasite medication they need. That could become a really serious issue if food gets tight. The parasite problem could increase for your pets. So while you're thinking about pet food, think about the parasite stuff too. And do that before you donate to my fucking podcast. But if you've done all those things, and you've got lots of resources, and you think it's going to be a Bitcoin future where we're all living on Mars in a few years. I don't know how that person would ever listen to my podcast, as my cyber stalkers love to say, I'm preaching to the choir. But if you have the resources and you want to support my podcast, feel free. I don't know. At this point, I don't think it really matters. But if you think it matters and you have the resources, feel free. I have to come up with rent for the summer because I won't be paid for a few months. I'm looking for a job right now. Could I use a little extra money to get by? Everybody could. I don't know anybody who wouldn't accept a little extra money. I don't know the people that are so secure right now that they're not worried. So yeah, everybody could, but that doesn't mean you have to. So having said all that, like I said, if you want to donate, you can, but you don't have to. It is Friday. Thank God it's Friday, right? April the 11th, 2025. It's almost 4:33, exactly 1 hour since we began this ride. And now we're traveling forward from 4:33 to 5:30 p.m. to 6:40. Take a poop. Take a shower. Go grab a flower, walk yourself to work, where you're gonna get paid to twerk. Have a great rest of your day, baby.